to Something Wicked Radio.
Listening to Something Wicked with Kevin Booth, documentarian.
Hello.
Kevin.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Julia Hollingsworth with Something Wicked Radio. How are you doing today?
How's it going?
Good. I just wanted to talk to you about Shadows of Sophia.
Cool. Respecting your call. Is the cell phone signal okay? Because I'm out here, out in the country. I'm hanging between two and three bars. Is it okay?
So far, it's okay. I'm just hoping the recording company that I'm working with is recording, because I never know if this is recording or not, but I'm just having faith. But
cool.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. Doing good.
So do you want to tell me about Shadows of Sophia?
Yeah, I mean, what do you want to know? It's like, I mean, dig into the, like, give me the more specific questions. Yeah.
Okay, well, what inspired you to make it?
Well, I mean, it's a kind of a long, crazy story. I was working, you know, a long time in the cannabis industry in Los Angeles, and a colleague of mine, who's going to remain anonymous for now, had moved a lot of his research and development things to his company to Bulgaria, and long story short, was overwhelmed by the amount of craziness and corruption, and he was the one saying, you need to go over there and check this out, this could be an incredible film. And when I went over there, I've always wanted to do a movie about Russia. I've always been fascinated about Russia, but it seems like every angle in the book has been covered. And I thought, like, this could be kind of my chance to do kind of a Russian-type story, but from a different perspective. And so I was inspired to kind of make a crazy movie about a crazy place that most people in America don't even know exists.
Well, I remember watching you get interviewed by Alex Jones. And about 4 years ago, you were talking about your secret project and giggling. So is this that secret project?
Oh, yeah, yeah. This is that for sure, for sure. I mean, that shows how long. I mean, in fact, I even interviewed Alex Jones for this movie, but it didn't make it in because I shot a lot of interviews stateside, but it just made the movie too schizophrenic, and I wanted the movie to have like a travel feel to it. So, none of the interviews that I did in the States made it into the film.
Well, maybe you'll have to do a second film.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
So who was on your team?
Well, I was working with Paul Thomas, who was one of the makers of the Bill Hicks movie. And he was another aspect to me getting into this thing. He did the Bill Hicks a documentary that came out in 2009. Are you familiar with that one?
American?
Yes. He was one of the two guys that made that film. And he had actually been traveling to Bulgaria with some other friends and filming the protests. And so when I got this idea about going there, he already had footage of it and all that, and he was already knowledgeable about it. So he became, you know, obviously to team up with Paul Thomas for this. You know, we got another young filmmaker named Christopher Barrett, who was the daughter of my manager then, Christopher Barrett. And she came over and helped me. And then the rest of the crew were Bulgarians who were, you know, friends and workers with these other people that we knew there. And that was our team. You know, we also had a security. But so we had a couple of Bulgarian camera guys. And, you know, there was a lot of... It was kooky for a little while, but we really got into a groove and had a great time making it. And in fact, we're still all good friends today.
Oh, nice. Were you ever in any danger?
Yeah, I mean, there's probably some moments, you know, it's kind of tricky. I mean, you know, I had security around me most of the time, so it's hard to know, like, exactly when the real danger was coming. I mean, there's obvious times when you're putting yourself out there, you know, in front of people, like in the Pussy Riot scene where we're putting the ski masks on the Soviet statues, or, you know, when we're droning over properties and things like that, so... There was always the feeling of imminent danger. I don't know exactly at what point, if anybody, you know, drew a bead on me or anything like that. I'm not totally sure about that. But yes, I mean, we had armed security detail around us the entire time we were shooting it.
Have you had any repercussions from this?
Not, you know, nothing besides just a lot of crazy news stories coming out of Bulgaria, which has actually just kind of helped fuel interest. You know, it's been a slow thing getting interest in the States. It's still a slow build. We're still working on promoting it here. So the repercussions have been just reading, you know, about a solid month of reading just insane things about myself and about the movie, which, you know, sometimes it hurts a little bit, but then it just becomes fascinating and crazy. I actually got kind of like addicted to like reading all these crazy things about myself. And you know, when it slowed down, I was like, oh, come on, keep going. That's great. So I don't know. So far, the only repercussions are just the press because, you know, as you know, the main guy in the film owns all the media over there, Dylan Pevsky. None of the Bulgarians are surprised at all about the things that he said or did. But it's really crazy reading about yourself. You know, at first he was saying that I was posing as some fake, I'm like some fake Texas guy posing as a journalist and that it, you know, I got accused of being a CIA agent by a lot of people. You know, they had, for sure, I'm working for the U.S. State Department. Because it's like, you know, people want to just... One of the problems when the movie first came out was that a lot of the people would just watch the trailer, a 90-second trailer, and derive all of their opinions from that, and then come at me, and I could always tell when they're coming after me that they hadn't even watched the movie. They just watched the trailer, and they just assumed that they knew what it was about, and they'd always come at me and say things like, well, you know, America does a lot of bad things too. And I'm like, yeah, duh. Yeah, you know, if you go watch my last five movies, yeah, I'm pretty aware of that, you know. So I thought this time I'd make a movie about Russia, you know, maybe I'll make a movie about China next time. It's just, you know, I'm allowed to pick my topics just because I'm saying some things about Russian, you know, collusion
and Russian, you know, backing and all the things that are going on over there doesn't mean that America doesn't do it either. But that was kind of the criticism that, you know, the off-the-knee criticism I got from a lot of people, especially Russians. It's funny when I can go on to certain websites like IMDb and see, you know, here's a bunch of 10-star ratings and there's a bunch of 1-star ratings. And almost every time you click on, you know, who gave me this 1-star rating, and it'll, you know, be some Russian guy who basically hates anything that says anything negative about Putin. And it doesn't even, they don't even watch the movie. They just look at the trailer and say, oh, this is Russia bashing, this is Putin bashing, you know, and then they try to slander it as much as possible. But it's strange because it in some weird way, it's like the bad publicity sometimes, I think, generates more interest to people. People read an interview saying, like, the guy that made this movie is really a CIA agent. They're going to, a lot of people are going to go, well, I want to watch that then. That sounds crazy, right? It's not, you know, so I think a lot of, like, the bad press has kind of backfired on them. And, you know, I was expecting it to come. So it's been kind of a game back and forth, right? You know, it's kind of coming waves. There's going to be another wave coming because they're getting ready to have another mayoral election over there, like what's in the film. And so there's going to be a bunch of interviews and stories about the mayor campaign.
Can you tell my listeners what Delyon Pevsky is about? Pevsky, I'm sorry.
Pevsky, yeah. Delyon Pevsky. Well, he's just a young oligarch guy who basically, when I first got to the country and I was thinking, like, well, most of the corruption is going to head towards the prime minister, Boyko Borisov. But from day one, every single person we talked to was like, oh my God, this guy, Delyon Pevsky. And he, you know, it's kind of like a hard thing to understand, but that's, you know, what I was trying to just explain to an American audience, which became very fascinating to me. And that was to learn that when the Soviet Union fell, Russia didn't just bow out and walked away. They left a mafia in place. And that mafia was run by the KGB, and today that mafia has become much of the government. And so you have these different players, all these oligarchs, and what happened was there was a very small window of time when a lot of big institutions became privatized, or that they did belong to the state, such as utilities, tobacco companies, gas companies, different things, banks, things like that. Once they had belonged to, you know, I guess they belonged to the Soviet Union, the country of Bulgaria through the Soviet Union, because at the time Bulgaria was a Soviet satellite for 45 years. And suddenly these things got bought up by individuals, and that's when the really insane corruption really started, because now you basically had a handful of gangsters taking control of huge government institutions. Delyon Pevsky has just become, he kind of became a symbol. I mean, he was put in place by his mother, and it's just the story is how this family, a completely unknown family, kind of just emerged out of nowhere and took all this control and all this power. And that's why, you know, and he's become just such a ruthless character with so many things going on all at once that he became kind of the symbol of the all the corruption happening over there. And so I've made him the main villain in the movie. It seemed like a no-brainer. You know, he was headed appointment. He was appointed the head of basically an organization that's a combination of the CIA and FBI over there without anybody even knowing who he was. And that's what started the whole country rising up against him. And he's like, you know, become on parliament and all these things. And everybody's like, who is this guy? How is he getting all this power? And meanwhile, he has all these, you know, all these off the book dealings with all these crazy things. And that ties in into the story into, a tobacco company. So, I mean, in the movie, the story goes that there's a bank in Bulgaria called the CCB. It's a corporate commercial bank, and it basically got bankrupted and plundered. Pevsky blamed the bank's head shareholder, a guy named Zoltan Vasilyev, for stealing all the money and leaving the country. But Zoltan Vasilyev claims that Pevsky took all the money, something like 10% of the entire country's GDP. And so Pevsky then used his media empire to slander Zoltan Vasilyev, even accused him of trying to murder him. you know, telling everybody every day over and over again in the news, this is the man who stole all your money. You know, it destroyed the life savings of over 8,000 people, and, you know, huge corporate accounts were all destroyed. And this became this huge battle. So in the movie, we were actually able to go and find this guy, Stefan Vasilev, who was hiding in Serbia. The entire country of Bulgaria was looking for him, but we were able to track him down through some underground journalists that are in the film. And that's kind of where the story takes off from there. This crazy tobacco company that once again had belonged to the state, and now it belongs to Pevsky and this small group of people. And then we discovered this tobacco company is being used for all kinds of other smuggling, Russian smuggling routes for drugs and weapons, and not to mention just selling off-the-books cigarettes. And a lot of they discovered, too, that off-the-books cigarettes were being sold to basically raise money to promote ISIS. And when we were shooting the movie, we spent a lot of time investigating ISIS and ISIS in the region. But when I came to editing the movie a year and a half later, it seemed like the ISIS craze had kind of died down a little bit, and it just felt too schizophrenic. It was already, you know, the earlier cuts of the movie were almost like watching three movies. People would just be, you know, if you think it's overwhelming and complicated, you know, you should have seen the earlier cuts, because it was like, oh my God, there's like so many things going. So we basically just had to get rid of the entire terrorism thread, because it just became too confusing and kept it all about the Russian backing and Russian collusion that thread through the movie.
I watched it 4.5 times in 2 days.
Well, that's cool.
I only it probably should have bought it, but I wanted to know if Pevsky and his mom were ever charged for money laundering.
At the end of the movie, it shows like they're being taken to court, so there's all kinds of appeals going back and forth, and so
I hooked up with this investigator who didn't want to be in the movie, but he's been investigating Pevsky for years, and this attorney, and they're basically using the RICO Act to bring Pevsky to justice here in America. So what happened was when they plundered this bank, $65 million, and that bank belonged to a Dallas, Texas-based company called Air Logistics. I don't know how honest Air Logistics were. I don't know anything about them, but they had done some land deal, beach resort in Bulgaria, and the bank and the money from the sale of this land deal, they were actually forced to sell the land. So it's even more complicated than what's in the movie. And that was, you know, a tricky thing about making this movie was I really had to dumb it down a lot just so people could understand what's going on. And so it's a frustrating line to walk between, because when you show it to Bulgarians, they look at it like, wow, you really oversimplified this thing. When I show it to Americans, I've screened it to a lot of American audience. They're like, you know, wow, this has got so many moving parts. And editing this movie became like a really fine art of trying to keep it moving, keep it entertaining, keep the story going. You know, it's kind of tricky. But so back to your question, though. So when they plundered the money from this bank, $65 million of it belonged to a U.S. company, this triggered a bankruptcy. And by triggering a U.S. bankruptcy, it allowed them to enact a RICO Act, which allows them to have to basically use U.S. jurisdiction to extradite and bring to court the people behind it. And so right now, this team of lawyers is trying to bring Pevsky and the Russian KTB bank into court in New York, and they're filing all these appeals because they know if they step on U.S. soil, it's not going to go so good. So they're fighting everything to just stay off U.S. soil with lots of appeals. And meanwhile, I think there's a similar lawsuit taking place in London. So, yeah, there's a lot of people going after Pevsky.
Yeah, what's the connection between Pevsky's media and the gas companies and the cigarette companies?
Well, it's not so much direct connections. It's like, other than he like owns it and profits from everything, but the media companies just allow him to basically just create the truth. I mean, the thing that's fascinating about Bulgaria is it's such a tiny country. So it's one thing to say, okay, we have fake news in America and there's fake news on the internet. I get it. But take a country like Bulgaria, where a lot of the population is still really old. A lot of the older people, they're not really like regular internet viewers. And so a huge portion of the Bulgarian population still just gets their media from, like, these magazines and newspapers and handful of TV channels. Like, they don't even really have clicks and things there yet.
And so it's still,
you know, as crazy as it sounds, it's able for, like, just one man or one little group of people to control what everybody thinks and hears. And so, you know, it'd be like being able to put out fake news in America, but we have all these millions of other options. I'm not saying they don't have the internet there, but it's just different somehow. It's just different. Everybody is just trying to toe the line. And so really, I mean, what he does with his media is he's able to basically destroy his enemies, and he's basically able to help his comrades, and he's basically able to get any laws passed or make any deals happen that he wants to. So he uses the media to basically just make everything happen that needs to happen. It'd be like, you know, it'd be like if some big mafia crime family in New York owned, you know, the New York Times or something, right? It's kind of like the equivalent of that. Imagine what the daily news stories would be, right, if that was the case. And I know some people would say, well, the crime family does, so you know, there you go. But I think what makes Bulgaria fascinating, though, is it's almost like looking at like a little petri dish of what's going on in America. It's like a little sample of what's happening here, and it's more defined. It's such a small place.
Did you discover the connection between Russia and here in the United States?
Well, I mean, in the movie, we make the connection with what's called known as the Magnitsky Act. Now, the Magnitsky Act was started to basically put sanctions on Russia and other countries for human rights abuses and other and financial abuses by when Russia would be caught doing things. And so it's been said that, you know, those early meetings that took place in Trump Tower back in June of 2016 with Trump Jr., a lot of that had to do with them saying, basically, because Putin hates the Magnitsky Act, and the Magnitsky Act is one of the things that could help destroy Putin's wealth when he finally gets out of office, which is said to be one of the wealthiest men on the planet. And so, you know, a lot of the dealings had to do with, like, Putin sending these lawyers to Trump Tower to say, if you're able to get rid of this Magnitsky Act, we'll help you destroy Hillary Clinton.
Oh. Is that how the connection hits?
Yeah, and then the other thing is, too, that the other thing that connects it is that the guy in the movie, Svetlana Vasilyeva, the guy hiding in Serbia, he has enacted the Magnitsky Act now against Pevsky. And so it's not just against Putin, it's also against Pevsky and other players. So it's a way that when some out-of-control dictator character, oligarch character, seems to just get away with murder, that a country can come and the U.S. can start putting sanctions on their financial interests.
Now, I noticed you had some beautiful drone footage, but at one point it just magically ends up in the trees. What happened?
We don't know. Something took over it. We were flying over Pevsky's. It took, like, over and over again trying to track down where Pevsky lived. We spent months trying to track down Pevsky or just even get a sight of him. And obviously, calling his official numbers and all that. So it got so desperate that we were, like, trying to just figure out, like, one of the homes that he owned. And we found these two giant mansions side by side, kind of cloaked in a much poorer neighborhood. And when you found this, it was like, wow, there's two beautiful mansions surrounded by way lower income housing all the way around. And in the movie, I make the joke of saying it's like the ultimate mother-in-law plant, because it's, I guess, one mansion belongs to Pevsky's mom, the other one belongs to Pevsky. And so we were able to find a vantage point, and we're flying the drone over it, and you know, we're not sure what happened, you know, but we did crash a $6,000 drone that we had to replace. And so I thought, you know, it was just kind of a crazy moment, and I thought I would just leave that in the movie. I don't know if it was hit by, you know, I don't know if it was like shot at by something, or somebody had a way of, like, there's also things where, you know, like, I know people have weapons where they can point some sort of a radio transmitter on it, it'll cause the drone to fall out of the sky. So
the drone was so far away from us when it happened that we don't know exactly what happened, but we were able to recover the smashed drone, you know, later on.
That's interesting. How much do you think the insurance would have been?
What do you mean?
You said you wish you'd had the drone insured.
Yeah, well, I found out later they wouldn't have insured it. I was, that was kind of a joke. Oh. But they, you know, like our regular production insurance. But I found out later that they don't insure drones like that yet. It's a little tricky. So, you know, it was an Inspire, one of those big heavy ones, about a 10-pound drone. Of course, they got better ones now, but it was an Inspire that we crashed. I actually crashed a few of them. That was the only crash that got in the film, but yeah, we actually crashed a few of them during the course of making this thing.
How much did you pay for the replacement?
I don't know. We bought it in Istanbul, somewhere around $5,000.
Wow. How did that work for you?
The new drone?
Yeah.
It was the same, exact drone out of the box. I mean, it's a DJI Inspire, so you just take it out and you calibrate it up and you start flying it and you hope you don't crash again. You know, what can you do? It's the kind of thing when you're doing risky business with drones, it goes with the territory. You're going to lose one every so often. You know, they're getting more and more advanced. I think, the newer ones now have more return to home stuff and more crash sensors and all kinds of stuff. But, you know, so this is like 3.5 years ago. So, you know, the technology has evolved, you know. The drone kind of became a character in the movie, or using it and always flying it. So I just thought I would put that little moment in the movie while I was editing. Just give it, you know, I wanted to kind of keep the movie kind of a road trippy kind of feel to it. And so a lot of people were saying, you know, make the movie more just like a straight ahead documentary. I guess you could call it more like PBS Frontline style. And then there's other people saying, no, it should all be a road trip. And I kind of went down the middle and made the movie somewhat of a hybrid where, you know, you get the feeling of this road trip and this team traveling around together, but then it's also like a serious political documentary built into this road trip. And so it's just little moments like that that I'm just trying to keep, keep it going, you know. And I know it's not everybody's cup of tea. What can I do? I have to make movies that are fun for me to watch because I get bored really easy.
Same here. But I watched your documentary 4 times because I was having a hard time trying to keep up with who. And then I figured it all out while I was watching it. So that's good.
Well, that's cool. I hope that's a compliment. I don't know. I hope.
If I'd have watched it once and done this interview, I'd still be prepared. But the fact that I watched it 4 times means that I wanted to really get it down.
Cool.
And it was that interesting.
Cool.
In your film, you had a young girl named Tawny who was 12 and then 13. I guess it was her birthday during the filming.
Yeah. All of her family. Well, I mean, that's another interesting story, too. It's funny because, you know, coming from America, I'd never seen real gypsies before. And by the way, I mean, you know, saying gypsies is the European equivalent of the N-word. You're supposed to call them Roma. So you say Roma in America, nobody knows what you're talking about. So, I mean, they're like real gypsies. And so I'm over there going, oh, my God, a gypsy village. Like, let's go. And all the Bulgarians are like, are you crazy? Like, you don't go to a gypsy village. I'm like, you know, why not? You know, let's go party with the gypsies. And, like, you know, I'm thinking, you know, fortune tellers and palm readers and all this kind of, you know. And so it's crazy. So we spent probably followed that family for 18 solid months. I mean, a lot of things didn't make it into the movie. I mean, funerals and a lot of, you know, life-changing events through the course of the story. And so we decided to just, I thought, like, it would be a very cool contrast to, you know, to like, in one moment we're sitting in like this $100 million property castle with a former king, the current czar, and then the next minute we're in a gypsy village. You know, I thought this was, to me, I thought it was really cool contrast to show like the extreme differences in the country. And so, you know, we kind of wanted to show, I just wanted to show like what the poverty looked like there. And so we followed this little girl and her family and became really good friends with them. And so The cool news is that since the movie's come out, she has recontacted us, and now she's all over my Facebook every day, and I'm, you know, she's posting, so I don't know if she's kind of riding on the fame a little bit, but I think she's more popular on Facebook than I am, so I think she's gotten something out of the deal.
I was afraid she'd been sold off. That was,
she's definitely very popular. Yeah, no, if you saw what she looks like now, I can send you a link of her page. I don't really want to publicize it out there, but you're going to be like, damn, she grew up. I mean, she's become a really beautiful young lady. I just hope she stays in school and does something with her life.
I think Mila called you the golden chicken.
Yeah. That's what hilarious. I love about those. I mean, that kind of stuff that would crack me up all the time. And you see, that's another kind of thing where, you know, when I put something like that in the movie, Bulgarians think like I'm making fun of their English, and I'm just thinking, you know, to me, it's just, you know, it's lovable. Like the, you know, the way they interpret English and the way they speak it. And I was just trying to make people feel like they're along the trip with me, and, you know, being able to hear Mila's voice always talking and, you know, telling us what to do next, and this kind of crazy Eastern European voice. But, you know, Mila and I, we were all still really good friends, and she's really cool. And yeah, I'm the golden chicken. Yeah.
And the golden chicken. And can you explain the riot protest, the one where you were talking about earlier, putting the masks on the Russian statues? What kind of troubles have you gotten in?
Be put in jail. You know, it's really weird, though, because once we got to go do it, we had all these people helping us and doing it. And the second we got there to go do it, every single person, all the Bulgarians, like, I'm not going to do it. And so the only people that would even do it were just me and Taylor, who also came from America. And even the bodyguards were saying, you know, you're an American. They're like, if the police come, they're probably just going to, like, ask you to stop because you're an American. It's weird. So you do start feeling that kind of like American privilege over there, which also makes people hate you. But when you're like an American stomping around with an armed bodyguard, everybody looks at you like you're, you know, think you're hot shit or something. So, you know,
Hollywood.
You're a golden chicken, right?
You're a golden chicken.
But that was probably the most scared I was during the whole thing. Because even the bodyguard said, you know, like, look, if the police come, we're not going to be able to help you. You know, you're going to be on your own. I mean, we can, you know, we'll send help to bail you out, blah, 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 all this. But, yeah, we can't just start shooting the police because we're trying to help this guy shooting, making a movie, right?
So, yeah.
Well, that was probably the scariest thing, because I would be more afraid of the police than I would be the gangsters, because the police can kind of do whatever they want in front of everybody. Yeah, but they didn't show up. A lot of people said they found out it was an American film crew. See, I mean, most of them just want to just get along, and so I think a lot of the police, like, the second you point the camera at their faces, and, you know, I learned this from working with Alex Jones, and, you know, that is, like, the second you start feeling afraid for yourself, start putting everyone's faces on camera. And that's a good way to make them back down. Because in this day and age, right, people know, like, one little YouTube video can basically destroy someone's career. One little Twitter post can destroy someone's career. You know, a meme can destroy someone's career. So, you know, you start pointing the camera at people, and they're like, oh, my God, it's an American film crew. They're pointing the camera at me. You know, I'm not about to, like, arrest this guy. That's like, for suicide. And so they would back down.
That's neat. How is the food in the Sambuca?
Okay, well, seriously, well, the food is awesome there. I mean, I feel like it's a lot like Greek food. It's kind of like, you know, it's right between Greece and Italy. Some of the best Italian food and tomatoes I've ever had, and pasta and things like that. And like, the Bulgarian food is very similar to Greek food. And, you know, it's funny because Bulgaria kind of feels like, and Bulgaria is supposed to, you know, because you always hear about Greek yogurt. Well, Bulgarian yogurt is where it really all started. And so Bulgarians will tell you that the Greek people basically stole a lot of their culture and were able to kind of, like, cash in on it better than they were. And so there's a lot of similarities. But, yeah, the food was awesome. It was great food. Now, the Sambuca, now that's a different story, because in the movie, if you remember, I went to this beach resort called Sunny Beach, which is basically the Cancun, you know, it's basically the cheap, it's like the Cancun of Russia, called Sunny Beach. And you know, we were purposely trying to find counterfeit alcohol, because everything out there is counterfeit. And so I believe the Sambuca I drank was counterfeit, and it tasted like rotten licorice. It was horrible.
That's what you said. How was the weed?
It was okay. You know, I'm from California. I lived in California for 13 years, so I'm totally spoiled. What can I say? I'm jaded as hell, but, you know, hey, it was good enough. It was okay. It was good. I do know that there's, you know, it was very illegal there, and I had to really sneak around, and the film crew and everybody was just appalled that I was even smoking pot. They thought I was insane, and they were like, dude, you go to jail. They, you know, I was probably in more danger smoking pot than any of the other things, you know, but I just, in my mind, I'm like, I'm just smoking pot. What's the big deal? They're like, you don't understand. And I remember the one time I got some pot at this big hotel. It was like a big fancy sealed up hotel where you can't open the windows or anything, right? And I mean, I brought this bag of weed up into my hotel room, and I left it up there, and I left and I came back. And when I came back to my floor, the elevator door opens. I could smell that weed. I could smell it all through the hallways and everything. I was like, oh my God. You know, I mean, it's like that odor from my room was just wafting through like a massive hotel. It was probably all arrows leading back to me. So at that point, I realized I had to be like way, way more careful about what I was doing. Usually whenever I ran off to like get high for a second, I was, you know, I would have to go run behind a dumpster and make sure the wind was blowing in the right direction. And I had lookouts. I mean, it was pathetic. It was really pathetic.
Spent a year and a half there?
Well, you know, I made 8 tours of duty, so there was like eight almost 1 month trips.
What did Trey do all that time? Did she go with you?
She went on a couple of them. Mostly, though, just running the show back at home. There was a lot of a lot of moving parts to doing something like that, a lot of moving parts.
If you knew then what you know now, what would you do different?
Well, I would have gone straight for his Vatan Vasilla. And, you know, the thing is about doing these kind of movies is that it took me a year and a half just to basically get in the door with, like, the people on the inside, right? You can't just show up to a place like this. You know, I liken it to doing a story about El Chapo or something like that. You couldn't just, oh, I'm going to go to Mexico and interview El Chapo. And now, I mean, you would have to somehow get inside the organization and move up the ranks. I guess, unless you're Sean Penn with a famous actress at your side. But, you know, from what I know now, yeah, I would go straight to, like, the source, to Tom Vasilla. But, you know, even having hindsight on that is useless, because it took all that time just to create the relationship and just even get a meeting with him to where he would agree to meet with us. So a lot of people in Bulgaria have accused me or accused and said that Tom Vasilla is the one who financed the movie, because, you know, he's basically trying to, like, make himself look not guilty. The funny thing about that was that I didn't even meet Satan Soloff until almost the very end of filming.
Now you're a benefactor?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you call him benefactor, but, you know, look, I didn't, you know, I don't know whether the man's totally innocent or not, or what, you know, because I've gotten a lot of flack from people in Bulgaria saying how, you know, you made this criminal look like a good guy. But I did what I had to do to get inside of a criminal organization. You know, it's like, if I'm going to do, you know, a story about Pablo Escobar, well, I'm probably going to have to become friends with, like, you know, one of his top lieutenants, right? How else, you've got to create certain relationships, and, you know, so, it's dicey. It's kind of dicey getting inside of stories like this. Especially when you don't speak the language, that makes it even 10 times more dicey. When half of the time you don't even know what the fuck's going on, people are all talking real fast, and you're like sitting there going, wait, you know, someone translate for me right now. I don't know what the hell's going on. There's a lot of, like, excited people, and so there, you know, a lot of moments like that where there were people running around all worried and crazy, and I'm standing there going, what's happening?
Right, like the TV show?
Yes, exactly like the TV show. Yeah,
I'm walking in there and all that, and I did barely even get to speak. I did speak a little bit, but it was completely ridiculous, and so I didn't even bother putting it in the movie because, you know, it just, that's basically what happened. I mean, they were just, they just sat me there like a prop to go, here's an American movie maker, and then they said everything they wanted to say, and then they thanked me for coming, and that was it. I had no translation device. It was funny because it was a live show, and the second the show starts, I'm sitting there going like, hey, I don't have a translation. I don't know, you know, I'm sitting on a TV show, and I don't even know what anybody's saying. This is literally happening right now. It was it's like one of those moments in your life when you're inside your head going, this is really happening. I'm on a live TV show and I can't understand a word anybody's saying. This is really happening. But I just sat back and, you know, I just took it all with a grain of salt and just say, hey, whatever happens, happens, right? Kept going, you know. And so I had a little bit of a cartoonish, maybe sometimes even immature approach to all this, but it's hard to explain. It's like when corruption is so bad and rotten, it's almost like I didn't even know how to approach it other than, like, you know, you guys are so over-the-top criminal and corrupt that I'm going to come back with, like, a movie that's, like, so over-the-top, you know? It's just kind of, like, the only way I could think of, like, to fight fire with fire. And I know, you know, historians and you know, experts, political experts could sit there and pick apart a few little facts here and there, little tiny details, and they'll use that to slander the movie. Where I was just trying to say, you know, how could we make this a storyline that Americans will sit through? Because that became like the really tricky part. And the sad thing is that Americans are just so dang tied up with Trump and everything that's going on in this country. Nobody even cares about what's going on anywhere around the world. And I just thought, you know, I'm just so bored and tired of everything. I just wanted to tell a story that people hadn't heard before. And, you know, it's not easy getting, you know, people to listen. I don't know if I'll ever make another foreign film. It was freaking brutal. It was brutal making a foreign film. Yeah. I mean, and not to mention that, you know, when you ask a Bulgarian a question and then they answer you and someone translates it, it almost always sounds like some riddle or something. And it's never, you know, you're always looking for, like, okay, I need you to answer this question so it makes sense to Americans. And, like, the answers never made sense when they came back translated. Just like reading a lot of these, you know, reviews, because I obviously, like, when the Bulgarian state media writes bad things about me in the movie, obviously I'm reading these Google translations or other translations, and it's just, like, bizarre sometimes to read these translations. Like the way their brains, you know, it's just so different. It's just really different. But to me, that makes it fascinating, and hopefully enough people find it fascinating too.
Well, I do. I want to see some of the articles, see what they, besides the CIA agent.
Yeah, I mean, I've been posting a lot of them on, you know, there's a Shadows of Sophia Facebook page, and I post a lot of them on there, and I'll try to post the Google translation. I'll post the Bulgarian version, and then I'll post the Google translation version of it. And you sometimes really have to just wade through it, because it's like when you're reading it, it's just hard to read. But one of the main things, besides a headline that says, watch an American pothead destroy the memory of Bulgaria for $5. That was one of the reasons. One of the other ones, basically this huge article ends up, you know, what's funny is that they'd always start off their reviews by saying, the movie doesn't make any sense. It doesn't have a real story. You can't tell what the movie's about. And then they would go into the most detailed, intricate description of everything in the movie, and you're like, oh, well, for a movie that you didn't understand, you did a really good job of describing it, like down to the, you know, down to like every little angle. And then it would end by, like, this one article ended by saying that, look, we understand this guy from Hollywood, he just cares about money, we understand that, but you know, if you're a Bulgarian, you know, and you rent this movie, you're a traitor. You're a traitor to the country.
Ooh.
Yeah. No, that's just it. It's all Black Mike's block there. That's another crazy aspect. No, it's not. You know, there's no, you can't watch it on Amazon there. You can't watch it on iTunes there.
I think, you know, I've been able to use a Vimeo account, but I think most people are probably just watching it over, like, Pirate Bay and stuff like that from the reports I'm getting. Like, they, you know, there's, like, a Bulgarian kind of, you know, BitTorrent type thing that everybody's using. And I'm fine with that, whatever. You know, just let them watch it for free. It's all good.
Yeah, I remember you used to give away your DVDs all the time and documentaries.
You know, it's a funny thing. I mean, I've learned, even with it was when I did American Drug War, that people would always be contacting me and say, oh my God, Kevin, you know, there's people on YouTube have posted your entire movie. Your entire movie's, you know, up on YouTube for free. And I would freak out about it, but I started doing little tests, and I started, and this is back when we were selling DVDs, so you had like a real litmus indicator. And I realized that the more bootlegs that were out there floating around, like entire copies of the movie on YouTube, the more DVDs we would sell. And so there's a lot of people on planet Earth. So if a million people want to watch it for free, then I figure, like, well, you know, then maybe a million more will pay for it. So it's kind of a word of mouth. And so, you know, if the entire country of Bulgaria wants to watch the movie, needs to watch the movie for free because the state won't let it through, like, official channels, you know, that's fine by me.
What angered you the most about this?
Just meeting, like, a lot of really, really cool people that are also very highly educated and really smart, but that are just kind of beaten down by the system. You know, it's kind of like when you take an animal and you put it in a maze, and this animal thinks it's living in this maze, and then you lift the maze and the maze isn't there anymore, but they still act like they're in the maze. Or the old, I'm not comparing Bulgarians to animals, I know I don't want to come off like that, but, you know, there's like an old thing where you people, if an elephant spends its entire life in shackles and then you take the shackles off, it'll still just act like it's in shackles all the time. I think what the Soviet Union and Russia did to Bulgaria was so powerful that it kind of broke the psyche of these people. And, you know, the same kind of gangster mentality is still beating them down now. And so you have people that are extremely high educated, you know, working for pennies on the dollar. And, you know, the average highly educated Bulgarian does not make very much money. And, you know, and of course people are going to hear this and they're going to go, screw you, I'm the head of IT for $100,000 a year, but wait, I know there's a lot of successful, and they're very advanced. I mean, I'm trying to say they're very advanced, smart people. I'm just saying that because of the level of corruption, a lot of really cool, intelligent, beautiful, warm-hearted, highly educated people are being put through like a horribly hard circumstance. I guess that's what made me the angriest.
So it didn't matter if you had money or not. It was just the system.
Well, yeah. Well, I'm not saying you have money. I mean, people with a lot of money there, they live like kings. I'm saying more like people with a college degree don't have any near the options. And when you learn, which is covered in the movie too, that, you know, most of the younger Bulgarians that do have the ability to leave the country do leave the country. And so, you know, Bulgaria is one of the few places on Earth with an actual shrinking population. And so you have, like, this demographic of more old people than young people. And on top of that, it becomes, like, the more motivated and more highly, you know, I don't want to say intelligent, but more highly motivated people that leave the country. And so, you know, multiply that times hundreds of thousands year after year after year, and it starts taking effect on this tiny little country.
If you had a TV show, like Bill Hicks' reality show, that he was going to go hunt and kill, what would your TV show be?
Oh, maybe just Kevin Booth investigates things. You know, I mean, I like just getting into weird stories and pressing things, and so maybe every episode would be like a different story. You know, I like to keep it moving. So, you know, now, like right now in Texas, I'm involved with this big pipeline fight. You know, I came back to Texas, and now we've got, you know, this big energy company, Kinder Morgan, wanting to put a 42-inch pipeline, not on my land, but on my neighbor's land. And this has turned into a huge deal around here. In fact, we've been starting to shoot a movie about this, and just about eminent domain and how these oil companies can come and take everything. And You know, and I've even used that when the Bulgarians and the Russians are sitting there talking about Shadows of Sofia. You know, how dare you say all these bad things about our country? Look at all the bad things in America. And I say, you know what? Why don't you come to Texas, make a movie about how corrupt the oil companies are, and I'll freaking help you. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm not going to sit there and go, how dare you show Texas in a bad light? You're missing the freaking point. That's not the point, you know? I'm making a movie about a criminal enterprise. And so, you know, dealing with people's pride. But so if I was going to make a TV show, yeah, maybe like a different investigation every week or every month or something. I don't know. I wouldn't maybe every week is a little too much. That'd be a little too hard.
So when you looked out the window and you saw people up your telephone pole, what movies were you working on?
What story is that? You're going to have to index me to what story I can't. Where'd you get that story?
You were being interviewed by Alex Jones. And you said that there wasn't a day you can look out the window and see somebody up your telephone pole.
Oh, that's when I was shooting American Drug War. And I was actually like talking to Freeway Ricky Ross and the CIA. My caller ID was freaking crazy, like a who's who of the underworld. It used to be funny talking to Alex Jones on the phone because he was always 100% sure that he was being tapped, and he would actually redact things. He'd be like talking and then going, "Now, okay, now the people recording this phone call, I didn't mean to say that. What I meant to say was this." And he would be making corrections while he was talking, like just assuming that he was being recorded. So yeah, I think that's what you're referring to.
And I think
at the end there, I was supposed to, you know, just all the stuff with Freeway Rick is what created that, if you know the whole Freeway Rick story.
I do. I watched your documentary. In fact, which documentary has been your favorite to shoot?
Maybe it was American Drug War. I mean, I don't know. They're always like, while you're shooting them, it always feels like it's this horrible thing that's never going to end, but then once you're done, it's kind of like, dang, it's over. So it's kind of, you know, but then the relationships you make with all the people continue. Just like, to this day, I don't think the gypsies realize that the movie's over. Even though they know the movie came out, they still contact me every day going, hey, Kevin, now this is happening. You got to come film it. And I'm just like, guys, the movie's over. But, you know, back to the telephone pole thing, I know what I was going to say. It kind of reminded me of the Gary Webb story because, you know, Gary Webb, they made that movie Kill the Messenger, and he was the one that broke the Gary Webb broke the whole Freeway Rick CIA story. And so he used to tell all these stories about how there's always people up his telephone pole. And people listening to this have to realize this is like pre-internet, this is pre-cell phone, right? So this is old school, back in the day where if you wanted to like tap into someone's conversation, you literally had to tap into a wire or something like that. Or nowadays, it's probably just over some computer network and there's nobody out there like, you know, alligator clips and wire splicers if they need to listen to your conversation.
Well, we know this conversation is being recorded. That's the point of it.
Yep, we hope so.
When I was listening to your interview with Alex Jones, you mentioned your sister runs the momcenter.org. What's that about?
Yeah, this organization here in Fredericksburg, they just help, you know, women that are pregnant that are going through a hard time.
Right on. And I wanted to say that I really give you thank you and kudos for your Waco Day 7. That was an awesome video.
Oh, cool. Thanks. It's weird. Ever since this Sandy Hook debacle took place, so much of what I've done has been erased off of YouTube. It's crazy. You know, I didn't really have control over it, but I think YouTube just systematically removed anything to do with Alex Jones and inadvertently. Oh, and that's another crazy thing, you know, that whole Bill Hicks, Alex Jones conspiracy that spun out and people blame me for it. And it just ended up creating like a real shitstorm and took down a lot of good YouTube videos that didn't even have anything to do with Alex Jones. Or deleted from the air just because of it.
Wow. Yeah, I never thought Alex Jones was as funny as Bill. So he was a lot funnier when he was Bill Hicks, right?
Well, you had to go out. You had to, like, I'm not the only one who said, I think Joe Rogan has experienced it too, but if back in the, I don't know, I haven't hung out with, I haven't even talked to Alex in almost 2 years, but, you know, back in the day, when you went out drinking, I mean, Alex was pretty damn funny. I mean, he was a pretty funny guy to hang out with. I mean, he could, you would have some memorable evenings. Going out to party with Alex Jones, you had some stories to tell, and it never ceased to be entertaining.
Right. I love his stuff, and I love your stuff. I don't know. I think you're my favorite documentarian. I don't have a second favorite, so there you go. You get the award.
Thanks. That's nice of you.
I wanted to say thank you to Frederick Trell for introducing us and to do a shout-out to him.
Hey, Frederick. We're just waiting for you to, like, get the Internet. Frederick asked me when my movie's coming out on DVD, and I'm like, dude, it's on the Internet. Well, come on, Frederick. Get rid of that DVD player and get on the Internet, and let's do this thing. We love you, Fred.
We do. We especially do. So what's the new twist in the drug war going on?
Well, you know, a couple of different projects. One of them actually is with Oliver Stone's son, Sean Stone. We've been developing called Drugs A to Z. Different exploration, but it's, you know, a lot of it's going to be about the painkiller scandal and all that. I mean, look, all I know is that, you know, I moved back to Texas. I have oral surgery in my mouth, like where they're cutting into my gums and my teeth. And I can't even get a damn Tylenol 3 because of some called opioid epidemic. And I'm like, what does some hillbilly dying from fentanyl have to do with, like, me getting, like, a Tylenol 3? And I've never broken the law or anything like that. And so I think a lot of this opioid epidemic is really, you know, I'm not saying, look, I know it's really easy to get hooked on opioids. I have before, and so I understand it. But I think there's a lot more going on here than we realize, and with, you know, like China shipping all this fentanyl and all that. So I think a lot of, like, how they're handling this opioid epidemic is very misguided. Very misguided. And I think a lot of another crazy conspiracy going on right now, too, is this whole vape thing. And that all these vape companies are being shut down when they're saying, like, almost every single one of these cases where someone got sick was from some street-made cartridge where they're using things you're not supposed to use in the cartridge. And yet, like, because someone got vaping-related illnesses, they're just applying it to everybody across the board, which is really messed up.
That's true.
Back in Texas now. But we're hopefully, the good news is here in Texas, they're going to allow us to grow hemp next year. We're going to be able to get licensed to grow CBD hemp here.
Right on.
So, yeah, marijuana is still illegal, and I know marijuana or cannabis-based CBD is much better, and I know it is much better, but the hemp thing does have a lot of good properties to it. So I'm hoping to get into, like, being able to grow some CBD hemp here out in Texas.
Are you staying in Texas?
Yeah, I'm living on our family's ranch right now, yeah. We've had this ranch since the 70s.
You moved out of Hollywood?
Yeah, I decided. I owned a house up in Laurel Canyon for 13 years. You know, bought it in 2005, probably paid a little too much for it. It used to belong to Lawrence Fishburne. And Pharrell Williams was my next-door neighbor. It was a really cool place to live, but, you know, it just... We didn't get a great deal on the house. We finally got a situation where we could get out of there with a little bit of profit. And especially after working on a movie overseas, and all I'm doing is sitting in front of the computer, and, you know, my other partners now are in Canada, and my partners are spread all over the place. I just thought, you know what, I could take a break from Hollywood for a little while. Hollywood's not going anywhere, and I definitely am not missing the traffic, that's for sure.
Oh, I know. I came from there the other day. It was pretty fun.
Where do you live?
I live in Durango, Colorado area.
Okay.
But I used to live in L.A. during riots.
Right, wow.
And I how jaded I became when I held the door open for the guy robbing the Chevron in Beverly Hills. And I was like, did he have a gun? And then I thought, oh, well, whatever. And then years later, I was like, oh, whatever. What kind of... And he did have a gun, so it was... I'd become too jaded. Had to get out of there.
Yeah. No, it's, you know, like, L.A.'s not going anywhere, and I get sick of the weather, too. I mean, it's, my God, it was so nice just to come back and actually see rain again. I mean, course, it started raining the second I moved away, but and I lived in L.A. for 9 years when I was younger. I don't know if a lot of people realize that, but, I was born in Connecticut, lived in Los Angeles for 9 years as a child, going through elementary school into middle school, and then moved to Texas. So, I've spent almost half my life in Los Angeles, which is a lot.
Yeah, got to get to Texas once in a while. So what projects are you working on now, the pipeline?
Pipeline thing. I'm in this thing up to over my head. It's crazy. I'm actually a commissioner there's so many different people there's all these hearings and people are like, oh, so you guys got the pipeline shut down, but there's so many moving parts to this thing. Right now we have hundreds and hundreds of property owners that are basically being taken to condemnation. So when a big company like Kinder Morgan says, well, we're going to use the law of eminent domain to just do whatever we want with your land, and there's nothing you can do about it, and you say, no, you're not, well, then they are allowed to condemn your land, and they put you in what's called a condemnation hearing. Well, we're just doing everything we can, because what Kinder Morgan wasn't bargaining on is how united, what would happen if they came to an entire... this is like a German culture. I live in a place called Fredericksburg. This is like a very German place. They didn't realize like that they're gonna like walk into like a hornet's nest of Germans who have had their land. I mean, these ranches have been in people's families since 1910, 1800s, and so for some private oil company to just say, oh, we're gonna come trash your ranch, it's just. And we're going to just give you like a fair market value for what the land is. It ain't going down like that. So there is literally like a million lawsuits flying, and hearings. And it's crazy right now. We're really in the thick of it. But the scary thing is that meanwhile, while this is going on, giant trains full of pipes are being loaded into yards around, because they act like nothing's going to stop them. And the sad thing is they're fracking all this oil. Out by Odessa, which is out west Texas, and they're fracking at a rate. And this is supposed to be their thing is like, we're fracking so fast that we have to burn it off. So we're trying to help the environment by building a pipeline. Well, eminent domain is supposed to be for the common good of the people. The truth of the matter is this pipeline is going to be used to take fracked oil from west Texas, and they're going to ship it to the Houston Ship Channel, where it's going to be shipped overseas.
Yep.
So there's no common good there, and yet they're using the eminent domain law. And the eminent domain law was actually created by the Railroad Commission in 1900. So they're able to use a law, a 119-year-old law, to basically steal people's land. And that law was created back in a day where, you may have owned 10,000 acres, and we need to put a railroad track down, or we need to put a telegraph, telegraph poles up, or we need to build an interstate, or we need to build a hospital or a school or something. That's when these eminent domain laws were created, and what they were created for. Well, they've never been changed. And so we are now challenging a lot of these eminent domain laws in both federal courts, state courts, county courts, going after the Railroad Commission, the Army Corps of Engineers, a lot of the environmental agencies. A lot of moving parts to this thing, and basically saying it's time to basically update these eminent domain laws. Because if they can get away with taking these people's land out here, it's game over. Let me tell you, it's one thing when you see a bunch of poor Indians trying to stop it, and that's a really sad, tragic story. But then you see a bunch of rich white people getting treated the same way. So it's like watching a millionaire getting like bullied by a billionaire is what it's like. And you're like, whoa. This is really happening, and if they get away with this, it's game over for everybody. If these people can't stop them, nobody's going to stop them.
Didn't they make it illegal to protest the pipelines now?
But that's like, that comes down to, I think, when you're like trying to put your body in front of like an excavator kind of thing, right? I mean, that's, I think what they're talking about is like you're actually stopping the construction. Which is what happened a lot on the Keystone, So I think as a result of everything that took place on the Keystone line with all the Indians, they enacted these new laws. But it's against the law now to protest, by the way, in America. Oh, yeah. Who would have thunk it?
That's right. Well, I'm out of questions. Is there anything you'd like to ask?
Oh, I appreciate your interest, and I hope it comes out good, and let me know. We should definitely post it on the Shadows of Sophia page is where all the action is for the movie. Not so much on my. I think everybody on my homepage is like tired of all the Bulgaria talk. You know, you can always tell whenever I post anything about Bulgaria, everybody's just kind of like, ugh. So, I'm sure I have more Bulgarian friends and more Gypsy friends than probably any American out there. So when you put this thing together, we'll post it. We'll make a real nice posting of it on the Shadows of Sophia page.
That sounds good.
Cool. All right.
Okay. Before you go, can you sign off and say that you're Kevin Booth listening to Something Wicked Radio?
Hello, everybody. This is Kevin Booth, and you're listening to Something Wicked Radio.
A Trump News Network special report.
We are glad to announce billionaire and everybody's favorite Donald Trump has won the presidential elections.
We are going to make America so great again.
Donald Trump made his first visit to Washington.
People have been maced. And the police look like they're blocking them in.
No more Muslims.
These are people that nobody knows who they are.
We better be careful.
No more Mexicans.
We're going to stop it and we're going to build the wall.
You have to come in to be an American.
They're troublemakers. They're no good. We've got to take our country back, folks.
No. Tell us, bitch. Yeah, that's right.
You
speak American.
Look at this. Russian fucking passport.
Sign American.
What are you doing here, man?
No.
You're going to understand.
In America.
Your fucking neck, you're going to understand. Yeah. Put your hand down. Burn it.
Stop.
Outsider.
No more small breasts.
What do you want the world to look like? What do you want it to be? Do you know that the wall has two sides and nobody is free? Did your mama come from Mexico? Papa come from Palestine? Sneaking all through Syria, crossing all the borderlines. Let other people in. The Listen to your women. Stop killing black children. Make America great again.
No more fat pigs.
Burn pigs!
Keep going. Hey there.
That's where you're gonna push your head.
Let other people in. Listen to your women. Stop killing black children. Make America great again. Dun 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 da 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 da. Dun 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 da.
Guilty. No more gay or lesbian.
Could you imagine a foundation calling a woman a dog? Do you wanna stay in the kitchen? Is that where you belong? How do you picture the perfect leader? How do you want him to be? Has he promoted the use of torture and killing families? Did your mama come from Mexico? Papa come from Palestine? Seeking all through Syria, crossing all the borderlines. Let other people in. Listen to your women. Stop killing black children.
Knock the crap out of him, would you?
Let other people in.
I'd like to punch him in the face, I'll tell you.
Listen to your women. Stop killing black children. Make America great again.
We'll see you tomorrow. I love the women.
Did your mama come from Mexico? Papa come from Palestine? Seeking all through Syria, crossing all the borderlines.
No more abortions.
Ha! Let other people in. Listen to your women. Stop killing black children. Make America great again. Let other people in. Listen to your women. Stop killing black children. Make America great again.
Down, right, yeah,
sadly, the American dream is dead. I will bring it back. Bigger and better and stronger than ever before.
Trump will make America great again.
everybody. This is Kevin Booth, and you're listening to Something Wicked Radio.